second research symposium on the late effects of poliomyelitis, Warm Springs, Georgia, 1986. Continuation, session number one, clinical aspects.
What we'd like to answer, first of all, from this group of patients is, first of all, are persons with a history of paralytic polio experiencing progressive difficulty? And what is the nature of the progression? Generalized fatigue, pain, specific muscle weakness. Now this is in 31 patients who have been selected. As it turned out, 14 of those patients were ones whom the original questionnaire had said that they were in some way progressing, and 17 had said that they were stable. So this is a selected group of patients from the epidemiological study. 31 patients have completed, 10 of them said they're having no difficulties, 11 report fatigue, 13 report joint pain, and 17 report some type of progressive weakness. And to put that in another way, 10 report no difficulty, 2 report fatigue as the only symptom, 2 report pain as the only symptom, and 17 report specific muscle weakness plus pain or fatigue. 4 patients report specific muscle weakness without any pain or fatigue, just muscle weakness. If we look at, I mentioned there were certain critical items in our questionnaire of 337 questions. From those we derived what we called a progression score. Now this score depended on the response to specific questions in the questionnaire. You would get 1 point for fatigue, 1 for pain, 6 for progressive bulbar symptoms, and then these other points for progressive respiratory lower limb or upper limb symptoms. Functional capacity, you could earn you 10 points worth of progression. New assistive devices, 7 points. And ADL or home modification, 13 points. So you get a total possible score of 50 points in progression. In fact, the distribution of those 19 people who reported, or rather the 21 people who reported progression, the progression scores are all very low. This is the number of patients, the 10 who reported no progression, and then others between 1 and 8 units on the progression scale. If you look at the reporting of items by individual patients, these are the numbers of patients who reported these specific symptoms. And I point out that only one had any progressive bulbar symptoms, none reported respiratory difficulty, and then these others as we go through here. So relatively or very low scores down at this part of the progression score, more reporting actual specific limb weakness without it changing very much their functional capacity or requiring any modification. And we asked some specific questions. Does weakness in this group relate to severity of disease, age at onset, rather that should be, does progression relate to interval since polio, age now, weakest limbs, supervening disease, and I just might mention sex ratio. The sex ratio was approximately equal, 16 to 15, in this group of 31 patients, and in the progressors it was 11 females to 10 males, so it was again an equal sex ratio. If we look at age at onset versus progression score, this is the age of the patients versus, this is the distribution of the patients, their age at onset versus the number of patients. And there was no relationship, we found no relationship in this group between likelihood of progression and the age at onset of the polio. So there's no relationship there. If we looked at the time, at the age, at the time of their evaluation, and this reflects Mary's earlier incidence, biphasic incidence rates, and if we relate that age at evaluation to potential progression, this is the progression score along the bottom. Age at evaluation, you can see there's no correlation at all in this linear regression. If we look at the interval, that is how many years since the person had polio, 30 to 60 years, we're looking at rather 30 to 55 years in this group of patients. Again, we find only an extremely weak correlation, it's essentially a shotgun scattergram, of progression score versus the interval in years since the time they had their polio. If we look at their maximum disability, now this is at the time they had polio from their old record, if we look at their maximum disability score derived from their neurologic record, and again correlate that with a progression score, there is some degree of correlation. The R squared value is 0.3, but you can see the points are very, very widely scattered around that line. That is maximum disability versus their likely or their reported progression. Now the electrophysiological studies, the needle electromyography demonstrated that motor unit potential changes were more widespread than the original clinical involvement suggested, and I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. In a given muscle, the amplitude of the compound muscle action potential, the motor unit potential count, and fibrillation potentials correspond to the severity of clinical involvement of that muscle. And therefore, in a given patient, there was a correlation between the clinical severity of weakness and the EMG changes. We'll come back to that statement in a moment. Now, if we took limbs and matched limbs for disability between patients who were saying that limb is progressing and others who said that limb is not progressing, so we've matched progressing limbs to non-progressing limbs, we found there was no difference in any of these electrophysiological variables. And I point out particularly that fibrillation potentials, motor unit potential count, variability of motor unit potentials, and recruitment, all of things that you might associate with progression, were equally common in people who said that they were not experiencing any progression in a given limb. So in summary, the electrophysiological data correlated with the degree of clinical involvement, provided us with some quantitative data to follow, and more importantly demonstrated the presence of other problems, but they don't predict the likelihood of progression in an individual muscle, and unfortunately at this time they don't shed light on the pathogenesis of the progression, although that we hope that with the sequential study, when we re-examine these patients in 5 years' time, that we'll get more information from this. Now what we did find a correlation between is when we looked at individual limbs. We've looked at 31 patients, which gives us 155 sites. That is a pair of arms, a pair of legs, and a set of bulbar muscles for each patient. And if we look at these individual sites, we're now not talking about patients, but sites. We get 21% of the sites have some reported progression. Now, if we look at those sites that were examined with a neurologic disability score greater than 8, that is, for an arm, that would be 2 muscles totally paralyzed, or 8 muscles 25% weakened, and the same for the leg, we've got 45 limbs with significant weakness. And in this case, we get 56% of them reporting progression. On the other hand, if we look at those that are not significantly weakened, 110 sites, only 8 or 7% report progression. And just in parenthesis, 6 of those sites related to the following. 1 was a generalized peripheral neuropathy on examination and nerve conduction. 1 patient had bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome, severe and previously undiagnosed, that was causing progressive hand weakness. And 1 patient had a long-standing schizophrenic psychiatric illness, so we're not quite sure about the validity of his self-reporting. Now if we look at the difference between arms and legs, I think we also get some significant data. We examined 62 legs, of which 22 were significantly involved, and their mean score was 19.1 for muscle weakness. We found of these significantly affected legs, 18 or 82% were reported as being progressing. Whereas of the arms, we had 18 arms that were significantly weak, and their disability score is very comparable, so they were equally weak. Only 7 or 39% were progressing, were symptomatically progressing. And in the bulbar muscles, we found no people reporting progression, even with previous significant involvement. One last correlation that we looked at was the creatine kinase, and this is the progression score that we've used before against the value of creatine kinase. This is our upper limit of normal here. There is an approximate correlation, but in fact only 3 of the values fall outside the normal limit, but they are all in people who are reporting significant progression. So in summary, the conclusions. In this group of patients, we've got 68% of them, in this selected group of patients, some degree of new difficulty. 55% report some progression of their limb weakness. In only 1 patient has this caused any change in their functional capacity. So reinforcing that this is not a severe degrees of progression that they're reporting. This occurs almost exclusively in limbs significantly weakened by the original disease. It's twice as likely to be reported in lower limbs compared with upper limbs, and one could speculate as to why that was. Do people notice or report lower limb difficulty more easily? Are the lower limbs more less readily adaptable to weakness? Does it reflect overuse? Does it reflect joint, weight-bearing joint difficulty? We suspect that the joint problems that these people are having may be very significant in this group of people. We found really the overall disability now at the time of polio, the creatine kinase and the electrophysiological studies were very poor predictors of the likelihood of progression in an individual. And at the moment, we have to say that the etiology of the progressive weakness, the hypotheses that we're testing, is this anterior horn cell loss, muscle disease, other systemic disease. We'll have to wait until we've completed the sequential studies. Thank you.
Jack Antel, in this very lovely presentation, the emphasis was on detecting motor weakness, as I understand it from the original survey. Do you have a sense that you would have also detected all patients who experienced some degree of pain from your original survey, or would have some people who thought they weren't getting weaker, would they have just said that things were going along relatively well? One is struck that the incidence rate of pain complaints seems to be markedly lower, I think, if I understand all the data presented, than in the larger surveys that have been presented by others.
Yes, I think the two parts, Mary's data, the original survey data, had specific questions about pain and about joint pain in them, and muscle pain, joint and muscle pain. And that again was explored in detail in the second questionnaire that was given to the selected patients. So I think that we did ask specifically about pain in joints and muscles, and we used that information as evidence of progression. That was a problem, an identified problem. And I think the figures show that the incidence, when you look at the whole group of patients who had polio, is much lower than one would have expected.
My name is Dalakis, and I age. I have several questions, but I'm not going to capitalize the whole time. One for Mary Codd first, maybe you can answer that. Is the incidence of new symptoms the incidence of new weakness, actually? That's what you're reporting. Is it from all the questionnaires, from all the answers that you got, are we getting a figure of new weakness?
Yes, I think so, because the detailed telephone interview, which I didn't get into necessarily here, because obviously it has some overlap with the clinical study, and we felt that too many figures from different sources would simply confuse the issue. But yes, we did specifically ask about new muscle weakness, new muscle pain, new joint pain. In fact, those percentages of that group of 30 individuals who were interviewed by Dr. Mulder, in fact, there were two-thirds of those, 66%, who indicated new joint pain. There were 14 of those 30, 46%, who indicated new muscle pain. And there were, I believe it was 70% is, somewhat over 21 of those who indicated new muscle weakness.
This is what actually we have been calling PPMA, the new weakness, and I disagree with the statement that Dr. Holstedt made earlier. PPMA, or post-polymyelitis muscular atrophy, does not really, is not specific for the muscle atrophy, it's for the new weakness. So it is really, what we're getting is an incidence of PPMA. Is that correct?
I think we have to be a little careful, because what we're talking about is reported weakness.
Reported weakness, yeah.
And as clinical neurologists, we know that people may mean different things by that. Now, we try to dissect that out, but we also know that people whose knee joint collapses or whose hip joint collapses report weakness. Now that can only be determined by sequential examinations. And so I think when we have our isometric strength testing and our clinical exams repeated in 4 to 5 years, we'll then be able to make a very definite statement about weakness.
One last question. I agree with all your sex and age ratios. We found exactly the same thing as really normal correlation. Now, the EMG studies, did you do the EMG studies in unselected, blind, two limbs, without knowing what the patient, if the patient has new weakness or not? And if that's the case, how do you know, how can you correlate that with the progression? If the EMG didn't know which extremities to check?
Okay, the EMG checked muscles in all four limbs. He had defined muscles that he had to check in every patient. Plus the neurologist selected two muscles, that is, for example, the biceps and the quadriceps, that would be checked on both sides, that he felt were moderately weak. Now, he didn't know whether they were complaining or not. So that meant that there were four limbs checked. And I guess it was, three muscles in each limb, is that correct, Jasper? Or four muscles in each limb?
A total of eight muscles were examined in each patient. When you do that and you don't know whether there's progression, obviously you have the risk that you'll examine only muscles that aren't progressing. But in fact, with that broad a sampling, you do get muscles that the patient subsequently report are progressing. So what we have is a group of muscles that are non-progressing and those that are progressing, in which we can then make the comparison. And that was the purpose for actually selecting it that way and doing it blindly. I think you have to do that in order to determine whether the EMG has significance or not, because we know you find changes in all the muscles, and unless you make a comparison blindly, you can't make the assessment.
Patton from Baylor. I was interested in your graph of the CPK versus progression.
Yes.
And I wonder, was that statistically significant?
The R-squared value is 0.4, which is not statistically significant. It's a trend.
So, well, it's not. No, it's either significant or it's not. And
it's not significant.
It's really not.
No, it's
okay?
not significant.
So there is no relationship of CPK value to progression.
That's in this group of patients, there's no statistical significance. That's correct.
Okay.
Walter Bradley. There are two questions that I'd like to ask. I would be very disappointed at the end of what is a superb survey at this stage if you didn't answer some questions that I think you probably got the information to answer. Now, one of those is the relationship, and to see you say, well, we'll wait until 5 years and we do a follow-up. All right. Now, one of those is, in fact, the relationship between the MMPI and other psychiatric and psychological evaluations and the pain, which I think you must have that information already, since you've got a group that that had no complaints and a group that had complaints. You ought to be able to make a conclusion that you could give us. So that's one question. The second question is really essentially the same in regard of the PPMA or progressive weakness. You haven't really told us whether there is, in fact, evidence of progressive denervation with fasciculations and fibrillations and those matters in the muscles which were progressing versus those that weren't progressing in people who weren't complaining. Now, again, can you give us that information?
Absolutely. The MMPIs on our Rochester group of patients, apart from the one who'd had inpatient hospitalizations for psychiatric illness, were completely normal if you looked at the HSD-HY scores, which I think are the most important. That contrasts markedly with our referral group of patients. I haven't talked at all about, we're also looking at patients who are self-referred to our institution. They have very abnormal MMPIs. Now, I'm not going to get into that at all, but in our Rochester group, there's no relationship between MMPI scores and symptomatology at all. The second is the EMG questions. In muscles that are progressing, one can certainly identify variability, fibrillation potentials, and occasional fasciculations. However, they are equally common in muscles that are clinically involved and not reporting any progression. So they do not differentiate between progressing muscles and non-progressing muscles.
Ernie Johnson. I have a possible explanation for the slightly increased women in the older age group they get polio, because nobody mentioned the ones they get polio when they're pregnant, and I don't know of any men that have had babies recently. Secondly, who showed that thing from NIH, or was it from NIH, where it said post-polio syndrome? I hate that word. It's too similar to premenstrual syndrome. But, God, I'm sexy. Okay. But anyway, there are 16 or 18 vaccine-related cases. We have 5 in Central Ohio. And one of the things the attorney always asks is, what are the chances of this little kid going to get post-polio syndrome? Here's a 2-year-old or a 1-year-old child that got polio. Finally, I think Jasper has got wound up in this, in too much of an elegant research study, because he's not going to shed much light, I don't think, on post-polio weakness, because I agree with Mario Dulakis that if there are 434 muscles in the body, and polio is a classically an asymmetrical disease, it's ridiculous to do standard muscles. Mm-hmm. That may be too hard on the study, but I think so.
Well, I to answer that question first, I think you have to make choices, which is you're going to look at standardized muscles, or you're going to find out which muscles are progressing. Now, we felt very, very strongly that if this was going to have any validity, that we would have to do it as a blinded study. Therefore, we couldn't get into the question of progressing muscles or not. Now, I think the important thing to mention is as well that virtually every muscle studied was involved. Yes, polio was a focal disease clinically, but electrophysiologically it wasn't. If you look, and this is new information I think, if you look at these people who had polio, yes, their left arm may have been the only thing clinically documented that was weak, but every muscle in their body has got well-documented, or almost every muscle, electrophysiological changes. So it really was a much more widespread disease than was apparent clinically.
Rostov, London. I'm incredibly impressed by the quality of the clinical data, which I doubt we could get in any London teaching hospital. Could I ask about some associated symptoms that I see in the acute post-viral syndrome patients, that is, patients who have presumably an infectious mono or an acute flu, and then have a relatively quick onset and no recovery from symptoms which are virtually identical to your post-polio patients. In addition to the symptoms outlined by Dr. Holstead, which are identical to the group that I see, and we must have 400 or 500 of them now, I ask for migraine or headache, and it may be classical migraine or headache as described as an uncomfortable feeling in the head, an arthralgia, which is morning pain and stiffness, which tends to get better during the day, and also an irritable bowel syndrome, which is wind, bloating, and alteration of bowel habit. And in the groups of patients that I get, they can be referred by either the rheumatologist, the neurologist, or the gastroenterologist for those presenting symptoms, but then are clearly shown to have, in my view, a post-viral syndrome with those as part of the picture.
I think that's a very big area for discussion, but certainly we do ask about arthralgias. We don't ask about migraine. We don't ask about irritable bowel, although all that information is available from their Mayo Clinic records if we wanted to go back and look for it. Thank you.
Munsat, Boston. Dr. Windebank, isn't it likely that a sizable number of patients who feel they are worsening, in fact, are not, and conversely, that a sizable number of patients who feel they are stable, in fact, are worsening, which we have some data mm-hmm. to show that. And when you're dealing with an N of 30, don't you have some statistical problems there?
Oh, of course we do. And, you know, we are presenting this as a pilot study. This is preliminary data. This isn't the end of the study. The study will involve, hopefully, all of the patients in this group, which is over 200 patients, examined at 2 time points. And I can't stress that enough. The only way to get information about progressive weakness is to do sequential examinations, of course, as you know. And you've been a major proponent of that, and I think that's critically important.
I guess I'm Donald Mulder from Rochester, Minnesota. I have been particularly interested in this study, which has been carried out, and I agree with the points that have just been made by Ted, that you have to have a larger group. There's one interesting thing about this, Ted. The selection of the original patients, which we reported many years ago, came about because Henry Woltman had started following in the 20s some patients who came to him with a diagnosis of ALS and who had just the post-polio syndrome. So that original group of patients which we presented really are all patients who were referred with a diagnosis of ALS or progressive muscular atrophy. And we presented them or wrote them up because we were concerned that people were making this misdiagnosis in a relatively benign syndrome. I think it's of interest that when you look at the Rochester series, you find that this particular syndrome is so uncommon that at least some years ago, Eric Alskog and I were unable to find any such patient in the Rochester group, although we did see it in our referral group. So I suspect that we're talking about more than one thing here, that we're talking about a group of people who are having increasing trouble as they're getting older, and then a very small group of people who actually are having progressive weakness at this time with atrophy.
I was just trying to switch the slides off, actually, so don't worry about it. I think we probably run out of time now, so I'll pass it back to Laura Hall.
I think if Ernie Johnson's going to say my study's ridiculous, I ought to have a chance to respond.
State your name.
Jasper Dalby. In order to define whether anything that we find is significant, particularly when it's partly, if not totally subjective, and EMG is in part subjective, as anyone knows, because the electromyographer decides where he's going to collect the data, you have to have a control without knowing whether or not either of the two muscles you're testing are progressing. The issue is, did we test muscles that were progressing? The answer is yes, we tested muscles that are progressing. We didn't know it when we tested them, but we did get some. Then, are those muscles any different than the same muscles that are not progressing with an equal amount of disability? And the answer is no, there was no significant difference between muscles with an equal amount of disability. That same kind of requirement is necessary if you're going to interpret a muscle biopsy. A muscle biopsy shows abnormality. Showing there's an abnormality in a progressing muscle doesn't tell you anything unless you've made a comparison with another muscle that is not progressing. And I think that that's what's key here. So you have to have standard muscles and then just show that what you've gotten are muscles that are progressing and non-progressing and are matched.
There's no way we're going to be able to answer all the questions that folks would like to ask at this time. In the interest of trying to keep us somewhat on time, because we are a bit over, we're due for a coffee break. What I'd like to request is that the coffee break is out in the lobby area, and if people would help themselves to some coffee and whatever goodies there are there.
Let it be seated. We're going to get started, and our next speaker is Dr. Marvin Brook from Seattle, Washington, who will be talking about symptom pattern and post-polio neuromuscular changes.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, both as somebody from Seattle, where it's nice to go to a place they don't have much rain, and secondly, as a patient who had polio, and was here briefly at Warm Springs. And as we heard talks earlier, it reminded me of my difficulty in finding exactly which muscles were involved, and being convinced there were more muscles involved than the average patient would be aware of. Thank you. Well, I wanted to talk about the importance of symptom patterns in evaluating post-polio neuromuscular changes as they presented to our clinic. The collaborators on this were Dr. Walter Stoloff at the University of Washington, Laura Schillam from occupational therapy, and Bill Kelly from physical therapy. And we saw patients coming in to the clinic. Our goal was to evaluate the large numbers of patients presenting with complaints mainly of progressive weakness, sometimes aches and pains, fatigue, and tremors. We wanted to find out what were the significant diagnoses that these people had, and also to try and assess whether there was progressive weakness going on, what some of the mechanical, perhaps expected problems would be. And what we did was to, after we got going, develop a detailed questionnaire to try to categorize the different symptoms they were having. We broke it down by the anatomical location, the time of onset of the different symptoms, and we also looked for the other things that have been mentioned earlier, the functional losses and related conditions. We also had them spontaneously describe their symptoms and picked out the spontaneous verbal and written descriptions that fitted into the different categories of types of weakness or pain. And then after a history and physical examination, we felt that we needed to define what we would characterize as progressive muscular atrophy after polio. So those patients who complained of progressive weakness and had a history compatible with polio and had no other identifiable cause of their subjective complaints, we did electromyographic studies on. And being aware that patients will often have small positive waves and fibrillations and other abnormalities after polio without symptoms, we decided to characterize those people as post-polio progressive muscular atrophy who had abnormalities of a certain type on electromyography as well as progressive muscle weakness. We looked for large amplitude fibrillations or positive waves indicating, we felt, perhaps a more recent denervation process, or unstable motor units when we did quantitative motor unit analysis with just a monopolar needle, looking for changes in the motor unit or late potentials. We did not do single fiber electromyographic studies or muscle biopsies on those patients because of the financial and practical limitations. Next, I want to, if we can have the slides on, show a few slides. This is just when we looked at the population of patients in the state of Washington who had contracted polio between 1945 and 1960. We did not adjust this for death, so the right side of the curve would be less than this is. But this is the frequency of cases in the state of Washington during those years and their age in 1985 when these patients would perhaps present themselves to clinic. So this is the population in the state. There are a lot of points to make about this. For example, there are a lot of people that have moved into the state recently, which may change the spectrum if it was different in different parts of the country. And then, of course, we were looking at patients who presented themselves to the clinic complaining of progressive weakness, and they therefore self-selected themselves from this overall population. After we had done our evaluation, we found only one of 50 patients who met our criteria for progressive post-polio muscular atrophy. We interestingly found some other diagnoses. One patient turned out to have multiple sclerosis. Another patient had polymyositis. And another patient had aseptic necrosis of both hips and really needed total hip replacements. But this was the cause of her complaints of weakness and pain. We had not expected to find this, and that may be one of the more significant things that we concluded from our study was that of the patients presenting with progressive weakness and other complaints, only one of them had what we felt were not only subjective and history and physical examination findings, but also electromyographic findings that we felt indicated ongoing recent denervation of muscle fibers. We looked at the population of people who came into clinic and had problems after polio, and this is just looking at the age of the population who self-selected themselves and presented to clinic. And you can see that the peak is around the fifth decade. We then looked at the types of complaints that they had put down on their standard questionnaire, and not too surprisingly, large numbers of them had fractures related to their weakness and osteoporosis, 42%. We did find a large number with emotional problems, 45%. We did not investigate that intensively further, and are aware that that may introduce some biases. 74% had complained of knee weakness, 38% fatigue, 76% pain, and 86% had questions about exercise. Would that help or not? We looked at the onset of symptoms in years post-polio, and you can see the weakness occurred 30.5 years on the average after polio. There was a pretty wide variation in this group. Aches and pains, 26 years. Twitches and tremors of different types, 18 years. This is just a graph of that, and you can see the peak is around 30 years for, in the solid line, complaints of progressive weakness, and the X marks are the pain. And this is similar to what other people have found. Of the 45 patients who had polio, no other diagnosis, we looked for other mechanical problems that might be causing their complaints. And at the top there, not surprisingly, many of them had problems with weakness. This was on a scale of 0 to 20, showing the greatest amount of weakness in a muscle group in an extremity. So if you had a grade 1 Medical Research Council strength in a muscle in one of four extremities, that would be 1. The other three were normal, that would be 15, give you a total of 16. So that indicates largely the amount of weakness. Contractures, the average patient in a total of 8 places we measured had 1.75 contractures. Recurvatum at the knee, a large number had problems with that. Leg length discrepancies. These are all, I suppose, understandable considering the amount of weakness. These are secondary problems, but they cause many of the complaints we felt of pain, and some patients described as weakness. The average patient had 1.2 types of therapy prescribed. Because we only had one patient with PPMA, we couldn't really correlate with this small number at this point in time the type of symptoms with whether they had progressive post-polio muscular atrophy according to our criteria. Not surprisingly, the amount of weakness that they did have did correlate with these secondary problems, contractures, recurvatum at the knee, fractures, and with therapy, and that's fairly understandable. The functional losses were pretty surprising. 36 of 46 patients, for example, had increasing difficulty with walking. 34 of those 46 patients had difficulty with stairs, 25 with transfers, 24 with work, and other functional losses were less frequent. Our conclusions were that there is a combination of complaints that's fairly frequent, pain and weakness, and a third of them have fatigue. But this needs to be carefully evaluated and is not necessarily an indicator of denervation ongoing as evidenced by our type of electrical studies. We also felt that there was a need to look for the other diagnoses, which we found, and especially to look for some of the mechanical problems that may be causing pain and functional losses. We obviously feel there's a need to follow these patients in the future to increase the numbers that we're following and also to follow serial examinations, but we don't have that data at this time. This would give us more objective measures of whether their weakness is really progressing over the years. And also we felt that there was a real need to address their functional losses and abnormalities in examination with the standard rehabilitation therapies that can help these patients. Thank you.
First off, I wish to be boring, but in any series of patients that are going to be described, I shall ask the same questions, partly because I think polio doctors are interested in the neuromuscular system virtually to the exclusion of any other. Can I ask you, therefore, if you have asked for migraine or headache, irritable bowel syndrome, arthralgia, autonomic dysfunction, and any problem with mentation in your patients, which are virtually the cardinal symptoms in addition to the ones Dr. Holstetter has described in the post-bowel syndrome patients that I see? And I could perhaps be boring and say that unless you ask for many of these other things, you won't find them.
We did not ask for those in any objective, standardized fashion. Our purpose was really to look at those patients who presented and answer our own questions. Do they have certain diagnoses and what types of problems that may be addressed?
Patton from Baylor, and I don't have irritable bowel syndrome or migraine. I was interested in your data, though, and I wanted to congratulate you on an important point that you made, that the patients need to be evaluated for other conditions. And I was interested that two of your patients had autoimmune phenomena, multiple sclerosis and polymyositis. Could you give us some more information about how the diagnosis was established in those cases and what treatment they received, and did the treatment make a difference in their clinical condition?
I don't have all the answers to that, because when we found those patients with other diagnoses, they basically were followed in different clinics. They were evaluated with the polymyositis patient had elevated enzymes, had more diffuse tenderness of muscles, and was treated with the neurology team. So we basically didn't follow them. Once they had a different diagnosis, we dropped them out of our study.
Feldman from Alberta. I would just like to ask you what you meant when you said walking difficulties. Could you be a little bit more specific about that? Also, just a comment that we found patients who even had such things as transverse myelitis years ago who were still walking around thinking, or trying to walk around thinking, that they had polio initially. So certainly your point about making sure other diagnoses exist or don't exist is very important. Thank you.
The complaint of walking was a very broad subjective complaint, an increase in difficulty of walking in recent years. So probably that does represent a overemphasis on that. There, I'm sure, are patients who complain of difficulty walking, and really it was more due to their brace needing to be replaced or adjusted.
You asked them about walking distance, whether the distance that they were walking previously and now was different.
We did ask them on our history examination, not in the standard questionnaire, and found that those patients who did describe difficulty with walking on a broad general question in the questionnaire did also describe, the large majority of them, a decreased distance of walking. They would have different reasons for that, though. It might be pain or generalized fatigue.
I was interested in your comment about, my name is Sybil Cole and I'm a social worker in Houston, Texas, and I was interested in your 45% identification of emotional problems, and I wondered who, number one, made that identification in terms of assessment, and then what type of follow-up, and if there is other specific information about that, and who I might be able to contact.
That was a subjective endorsement of emotional problems by the patients on the questionnaire, and we did follow up with that and refer them to different people as appropriate, some of them to psychology, or there were only two patients who had problems we felt significant enough to need psychological intervention, psychology and psychiatry. That is a limitation in our study, though. We did not select out for subjective increase in complaints due to emotional problems or due MMPIs on this group.
But the patients themselves then identified that they had emotional problems?
Right, they endorsed that on the questionnaire. They said themselves they had emotional problems.
And did they specify what types?
They did, though we have not categorized that data or summated it.
Thank you.
This is Ian to side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.